So hello and welcome to another Loose Heads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union. I'm Chris Hill and it's yet again another special podcast this afternoon. I have the usual cast of Rob Shotton, Mark Shotton and Dave Nicol with me, who are of course the co-founders of Loose Heads. Guys, how are we doing today?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent. And the guys have been producing some brilliant content over the last couple of weeks. And one of the things that's been really successful has been the Instagram Lives with Ugo Monnier. We saw Heather Fisher, John Barkley and Danny Kerr on there this week. So keep an eye out for those. I think they're running weekly now, aren't they, guys?
They are, yeah.
And some great, great interaction and great feedback.
Yeah. Really good. Really good. Ugo's been really good at, you know, getting some really good content out for us. So it's been good.
Great stuff. And of course, when this podcast will be going live, it is during Mental Health Awareness Week. So do check out all the stuff Loose Heads are doing on the social medias and on the website, as well as the partners team Mental Health, who do great work alongside Loose Heads. But with it being Mental Health Awareness Week, we're very, very pleased to introduce this special podcast today, because we have got on via Zoom and on the podcast, it is none other than the Loose Heads patron, Sean Edwards. Sean, how are we doing today?
I'm fine, thank you. I managed to do a little bit of rehab exercises this morning, so my head's in a good place, as it usually is after exercise. That's, you know, for me, that's the key. One of the keys to mental health is to be able to do something physical. I'm not able to do all the things I want to do because of past injuries, etc. But what I tend to do is I do my rehabilitation exercises, but I don't have a rest. And that gets the heart pumping and the sweat. And afterwards, you just feel a different person, don't you?
Very true.
Yeah, because Rob, you mentioned last week, didn't you, on the podcast, that keeping active during this time is equally as important as everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you can get out for just a half an hour jog or a bit of exercise, it really, really does, you know, clear the mind and really, you know, improves that mental fitness.
Totally agree, lads.
And as we mentioned there, Sean, obviously you are the patron of Loose Heads, and I believe the story about how that came about involves a Wales win back in the Six Nations in 2013 and Mark bumping into you in a service station. Is that right, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. A bit embarrassing for me. Yeah, I was, my wife, who's a Welsh girl from just up the valley from Bridgend, she'd won tickets for the Wales-Scotland game up in Murrayfield, and we went up there. It was the game, the precursor to when Wales then took England apart back at the Millennium Stadium and consequently won the Six Nations. But we'd left the game. My God, Murrayfield's a cold place. And we got in a car and we drove back and we called in for a cup of tea at a service station. One man and a dog there, you know. And in walks the fairly unmistakable image of Sean Edwards. And my wife said to me, "Oh, look over there, there's Sean Edwards. You used to play rugby with him 1,000 years ago, didn't you?" "Yeah, I did, yeah." So I walked over. Sean was buying a cup of tea and a Mars bar, I think. And Sean, you might not remember, we played a bit of rugby 1,000 years ago, blah, de blah. And he looked at me, complete blank, and he said, "Right, yeah, great. What position did you play?" "Well, I was in the back row. You were mostly a centre." "Right, yeah. Lovely to meet you. Sorry, I've got to get off." And that was it. So I walked back to my wife and a bit tail between my legs, if I'm honest. And she said, so you never played with him then?" And I said, "Well, evidently not, no." And literally 4 or 5 minutes later, the same image came back in. He got a chair, turned it round the opposite way, sat down and looked at me, as probably only Sean Edwards can look at somebody, and said, "Did you stop me taking a kick against Yorkshire?" Which actually I did. And he said, "In all seriousness, I'd have got that kick, you know." And we had a hug. And actually, one of the things we've been talking a lot about, Loose Heads, is getting back in touch with your mates. And contacting those old teammates you've got that, you know, they may have gone missing a bit from training over the years. And it's so vitally important just to keep part of that community. And that, for me, was a very special moment. And when I had the idea, the the belief that Looseheads could be something. There was only one person I was ever going to contact to be the patron of our foundation, and that was Sean Edwards. I mentioned it to Rob and Dave, and absolutely. And when I had that conversation with Sean back in 2017, he said, absolutely, Mark, I'm in. We wore the same colours once, and that's what matters. And do you know what? That's the way it goes, isn't it?
You know what? Actually, funny enough, the reason I was driving back myself from Scotland was I was going to a presentation for my father, who was probably one of the reasons I accepted the job as the head of Looseheads, because my father suffered great mental difficulties after his retirement from rugby at the age of 24. He suffered depression, and you know, you're 24 years of age, and rugby's the game that gives you your manliness, isn't it? You know, and because my father was being inducted into the Warrington Rugby League Hall of Fame. Even though he played until he was 24, he had nearly 300 appearances by the time he was 24. And I was on my way down to a presentation, which he didn't know he was being inaugurated into the Hall of Fame of Warrington. And so I turned up, and he goes, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Oh, I'm just going to this to you. It's nothing." And we ended up being, him and Alex Murphy was there as well. And my dad was inducted the very next day into the Hall of Fame. So it's two things married together.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say, Sean, you know, you spoke about your dad there, and I saw an interview that you did actually during the Six Nations with the Rugby Journal, and you went into detail about sort of your dad's career and those injuries that he did suffer. So was that really the main drive then for you to get involved with Looseheads? Because we see it nowadays, don't we, how much injuries do take the toll physically on players, but mentally is equally as important.
Well, I mean, if you... playing rugby is such a physical game, you're going to get injured at times. The long-term injuries, there's no doubt they can bring on a little bit of depression, but career-ending injuries at 24, you know, with very little chance of it actually working again as well, because it was a spinal injury, you know, it's just probably, you know, besides not being able to walk again, etc., it's pretty, as bad as it gets, really, isn't it? And, you know, that self-esteem, you know, that you're, you know, quite, we all have that, you know, a lot of rugby players, you have that macho feel about yourself, you know, it's like a boxer, isn't it? When he retires, you know, that, you know, the special, it makes you feel special, doesn't it? And, you know, to have that taken away at 24 must have been very difficult.
And like you said, Sean, you're obviously now the patron of Looseheads, and you must be really proud as well. And, you know, you're all working across the world with Wales and now obviously France, but when you get the time to go on social media and have a look at Looseheads' website, you must be really proud of the work the guys have been doing.
Yeah, and as I said, I'm pretty sure if in my father's time, if there had been such organisations like you lads, they would definitely would have aided his recovery, really. So, well, as I said, when you asked me, you know, I mirrored the two things up and I thought, yeah, this is... we don't want lads having to go through this on their own, you know, retirement and, you know, other things that obviously affects us mentally.
Definitely, definitely, Sean. And of course, as Mark mentioned there, in terms of your playing days, Mark did play with you during the schoolboy days. I mean, Mark, what was that like to play alongside Sean?
Well, my memories, we played together aged 15 and 16. Yeah. I think most people's popular image of Sean Edwards is the gnarled, probably recently Welsh tracksuited, or with his blazer on and a daffodil, always dissatisfied with the status quo, etc., etc. It's a worldwide image, that of Sean Edwards. Take you back the 1,000 years ago when we played together. We were lads, we were kids. I grew up in Widnes, playing rugby league at primary school. Sean grew up in Wigan, played for Wigan St Patrick's, the legendary Wigan St Patrick's. He was a bit of a cult hero then. But I can tell you, when I played rugby union with him, he was the best player on that pitch. He was comfortably the best player I ever played with. But every one of us knew that he had something different to all of us. He was a professional then at 15. And the games we won, what was the unique thing about that team? Very successful side for Merseyside schools in Lancashire. Well, the unique thing was bit like when you played with Michael Jordan, if you played basketball with him, we had Sean Edwards. And it sounds a bit bonkers to say that, but to see he's made being a defence coach an absolute trade. That was no surprise to me going back those years. An absolute privilege to have been born in the same year as him.
Well, I'd rather coach attack, but unfortunately, they always give me the defence job. I prefer to coach attack. Most defence coaches are actually frustrated attack coaches because they think they can do the attack better than the attack coaches, and I'm no different, to be honest. So, but yeah, I think we're all good at certain things, so I'll stick to the defence at the moment.
And Mark mentions there, Sean, sort of how much detail you went into the game at that young age and how much you enjoyed playing at schoolboy level. Was that always something that you really wanted to take into your learning about the game and your knowledge about the game, that you wanted to keep learning, using those finer details to make your team and yourself better?
Yeah, I was almost like a semi-professional when I was 13. Probably two guys helped me immensely. Obviously, my father and my mother. But two guys, a guy called Jeff Lyon, who used to be a great forward for the Wigan in the 60s. He's passed away now. Another gentleman called Mick Clure, who were two lads. They were sort of associated with Wigan Harriers at the time. And that we used to train at the track, and Mick had his gym there. And I was pretty much training as a professional from being 12, 13, training 5 days a week and having, probably one day off a week from the training, with lifting weights, obviously not massive weights, but lifting weights from being 13 to help aid speed and et cetera, and explosiveness. So, most of my life, I always remember, I've pretty much been a guy who takes the rugby seriously,
And Mark, you mentioned captaining Sean. Did that kind of help as well in a team where you had someone who was just fully committed to everything about the game for 80 minutes and above that as well?
Well, the story about how I became captain of that little team that we played together was Chris Kedge, who was the coach, walked into the changing room in Sedgley Park, North Manchester, and looked around the team of players 10 minutes before kickoff. So this is no way to select a captain, by the way. And he said, right, lads, who's captain of their school team? Sean put his hand up, I put my hand up, and he looked at us, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and chose me.
He chose it.
Yeah. 10 or 12 games that season. Quite frankly, we were a good side. It was a county side. Most of that Merseyside schools team went on to play for Lancashire. I was fortunate enough to captain that. But, people don't probably notice this. Maybe they don't care. But Sean went on and captained, if I'm right in thinking, England Schools Rugby League and England Schools Rugby Union.
Yes.
We see him as a coach. I can tell you, he was with his Welsh boots. we had a great time. I mean, all we wanted to do was to play rugby. That's what kids do. And if you have any talent, you should take it as far as you possibly can. And that's all I've ever encouraged anyone I've ever coached to do.
And you say that, Mark, that everyone wanted to play rugby, but I believe, Sean, as well, you were quite the talented athlete when it came to athletics in terms of, am I right, saying long jumping and hurdling? Is that right?
No. I used to run 400 metres. I had the worst event, the hardest event. All my mates, my mate was a discus thrower. The other mate was a javelin thrower. So they're eating sandwiches and having chocolate and all that. And I'm thinking, nearly being sick with nerves because I've got to run 400 metres in a minute in the next hour or so. So, yeah, I put the toughest event, unfortunately. But to be honest, athletics for me was a means to an end. I was never good enough to become an international athlete. I was an average club athlete. But there's no doubt it made me a lot fitter. And let's be honest, I don't think anyone trains harder than athletes, 400 metre runners and 800 metre runners. And I carried that on all the way through to when I was playing for Wigan. I trained with a guy called Chris Butler, who then became our strength and conditioning coach down at the track. And he coached junior internationals, a guy called Paul Causey, who was one of my best mates then. He was 18, he won 147 for 800 metres, 147.2. So he was like, you're talking elite level. So these guys are running around the track, and I'm trying to keep up with them. And in between set of 200 reps, we jog 100 metres, then we do another 200. And then in the jog, they're all chatting to each other because they're so unbelievably fit and they're not carrying, you know, not quite as hefty as the rugby guys. And they start talking to me, and I'm like, can you just fucking shut up? But then I got used to it, and I could do a little bit of chatting after that. But I'll tell you, mate, at first, oh, God, it was an absolute shock to the system. Different level, mate, different level.
Because I was going to say, was rugby and rugby league in particular always a route that you go down, Sean? But I think if, you know, it said there, the 400-metre running didn't quite work out for you, so was rugby always going to be the number one route for you when it came to sport?
Yeah, the reason I did athletics was to make my rugby better.
Right.
You know, obviously, if you're fast, I don't think there's not many sports in the world, if you're faster, it's an hindrance, is it? So every single sport in the world, if you get faster, it's going to help you in the game. And certainly rugby is obviously one of those games. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I took athletics, you know, semi-seriously, not as serious as I did rugby, obviously, but, you know, it's something that I wanted to get better at to aid my rugby.
And you mentioned your father before as well, Sean, and at the time I saw an interview as well that you said that he was Warrington's world record signing when he joined the club. And I guess with that, was he just the main influence and the biggest influence on you growing up and taking rugby league seriously?
Well, yeah, my father and my mother. My mother's, I think I've had the worst tellings off from my mum, or bollockings, if I'm okay for saying that on here, off my mother. And she's definitely one I'm most scared of. So, yeah, they're both very, very positive behind me. But as I said, people like Mick Clure, Jeff Lyon, and obviously all my schoolmasters, rugby masters, starting with Steve McLeod, who was the person who actually sent me for trials for rugby union. You know, it's a little bit unusual to play league and union. We were really rugby league players playing rugby union. But Mr. McLeod had the foresight, you know, to send us there for trials, and you know, I'm very thankful for that, what he did.
Because I was going to say, Sean, on that, what was the decision for you to go down league to begin with and then union? Was it just because maybe more teams were interested in you at the time from league, or what was it?
No, well, I come from a poor family in Wigan. You know, my mum and dad, you know, as I said, my father had to finish, couldn't work after he played rugby because of his spinal injury. And, you know, let's be honest, every lad who grows up in Wigan, no disrespect to rugby union, but rugby league's the main sport in Wigan, even more than soccer. I think the crowds, even when Wigan was in the Premier League, Wigan Athletic in the Premier League, I think the rugby league still got more crowds than then. I'm not sure about that, but I won't be far off wrong, I don't think. So rugby league's massive game in Wigan, and it is in the north of England, as anyone who lives up there will tell you. Down the south, obviously, it's not quite so big where I live now. But you know, it was everyone's dream really to play for Wigan. My hero was Henderson Gill, who I ended up being his roommate in Wembley Cup final when we beat Hull in 1985. Two years earlier, you know, I'm on the terraces singing "Give It to Gilly." And waiting for him to score a try so he can give his famous celebrations. 2 years later, I'm rooming with him. Awesome, eh?
Exactly what we all dream of doing, watching heroes and then a couple of years' time playing with them. And on the Wigan stuff as well, Sean, I know in another interview that you did that Widnes at the time were looking at you during the school days. And I know Mark is a man who loves his Widnes rugby and a big fan of Dougie Lawton as well. And I know he approached you and at a time where you said, oh, I've had probably one of the worst games, but Dougie is someone that you really respected at the time, though.
Yeah, I had the worst game ever. I got sent off. I was fighting. All I wanted to do was, I had vendettas going on through the game. I played terribly. And that was it. I thought, this, I'm never going to be a professional rugby player now. I'm virtually in tears, like, going home, walking home, and this car pulls up at the side of me. And he gets out. I thought, that's Dougie Lawton. I'll never see Dougie Lawton again, because he came to watch the game. He followed me all the way home. on the bus and pulled over. He said, listen, I know you're a decent player. I just wanted to see if you've got any bottle or not. And I thought, well, at least there's one thing I tried proving today. Because he had a fight with every player in the opposition. I think I probably proved that, don't I? And I actually thought that, you know, my professional career was not going to happen because I play so shit. Bad, I mean. And he followed me all the way home. And he just showed how smart an operator he was when he came to an unbelievable talent spotter. I'm not talking about me. I'm thinking about all the rugby union players. People like Imosi Koloto, who I met a couple of years ago in New Zealand again, who, you know, let's be honest, he wasn't an household name, even in rugby union, and he came over and he was a fantastic rugby league player. And there's so many incidents of Dougie, you know, getting it right when it comes to picking the players.
Yeah, and I think I'm right in saying, Sean, as well, you signed your full contract with Wigan when you were 17. And I read a story as well that apparently the press had got the figure wrong for the amount of money you were being paid. And everyone was looking at this 17-year-old Sean Edwards going, why is he getting paid this amount?
Yeah, well, they forgot to mention, you've got to remember, smaller amounts, it's less newsworthy, isn't it? You know what I mean? What I actually got was 10 grand. I got 10 grand with £5,000 every year if I was playing in the first team for the next 4 years. And another 5,000 if I played for Great Britain. But they forgot to mention that bit. They just thought I got 35,000 up front, which, you know, I could buy a house with it. You know what I mean? Back in them days. And probably a couple of houses. But as I said, the press, God bless them, they forgot to mention the fact that I had to play for 5 years in the first team and play for Great Britain to get the full 35,000. But anyway, I suppose it was a newsworthy story.
But on a more serious note, Sean, to sign for Wigan at 17, you said that before that every lad in Wigan would probably dream about playing, pulling on that red and white shirt and playing for Wigan. So that must have been a really proud moment for you to sign on that dotted line and say, this is my career now.
It was, and you've got to remember, Wigan were the best team at the time, along with Hull, probably. And I think it was, my dad used to write me a little, like, comments about how I'd played and stuff like that in this book. And he wrote, well, Sean's just going to make a decision. Does he want to play potentially at Wembley in front of, you know, 15,000 Widnesians who, let's be honest, were there nearly every year and were the best team and were used to winning? Or does he want to play in front of 40,000 Wiganers like who've never been there for 20 years? You know, we hadn't been to Wembley for 20 years by that time. And that sort of made my mind up that I wanted to play for Wigan, and it ended up being the right choice.
I think it being the right choice, Sean, is a bit of an understatement from your part, because I think in your career was 9 Challenge Cups, 8 Championship titles and 3 World Club Challenges. So I think it was probably the right decision from you. And you sort of mentioned playing at Wembley in front of the Wigan fans, and sort of the Challenge Cup final that you mentioned in 85, I think, against Hull FC was kind of the moment where the silverware started to really come in for Wigan. So was that a special moment for the club, but obviously a special moment for yourself as well, because I know you scored quite a try in that final?
Yeah, I mean, I played at Wembley the year before against Widnes and got beaten, because Widnes nearly always won at Wembley. And we went there as pretty inexperienced. I think we were happy to be there. But when we went there the year after, and it just shows how experience does help you, you know, the year later, it was kind of a different feel. You know, we were there to win, and that was it, you know. And fortunately, we ended up doing it in what's remembered as one of Wembley's great finals. And I think defence coaches nowadays would probably look at some of defences and think, you know, there's some not great defending. But at the time, it felt like a really physical game. I remember the first kickoff, they kicked it off to me. I was playing fullback, and I just took it up with a run as hard as I possibly could. And I got absolutely creamed. I had a cut in my mouth about to 3 or 4 stitches out in after the match. But I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a tough day today. First stitch up, I think I'm rubbing in all the venom I can, and I get absolutely slaughtered. Smashed on my back, cut lip. Boom, welcome to the Challenge Cup final.
I love the way you said there, Sean. Oh, yeah, I must have cut on my lip, but I'll get the stitches after the game. None of this going off and getting the treatment during the game.
Well, as long as there was no blood coming out of my mouth, but it was blood. There was no blood bins in them days, I don't think. So, you know, we like to carry on, but yeah, I had to have a few stitches after the game. It's just a horrible place to get to have a stitches in your mouth, isn't it? It's horrendous. And I was like, oh no, anyway. But as I said, it was game on, and we ended up winning 28-24, I believe.
And at that time, did you sort of see the change in Wigan and this could be the real rivalry to win this? Because as I said then, they went on to win quite a few trophies after that day in Wembley.
Yeah, I think a lot was, you know, obviously coaches did a great job, the players did a great job, but the people on the board, the four directors we had, unfortunately, very recently, Jack Robbie just passed away very recently. He was on the board throughout the old period where I was at Wigan. And I think the Wigan people have got a lot to thank to people like Maurice Lindsay, Jack Robinson, Jack Hilton, and Mr. Rathbone, Tom Rathbone, because they were the guys who put the money in, bought the best players from all around the world. And the big thing about Wigan, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, you win things only at Wigan, for Wigan, because you've got all the best players, etc. But the hardest thing was keeping your players in the team. Because you knew, if you had a couple of bad seasons, you're up the road, you're gone. And obviously that created pressure, which was a good thing, because it was a pressurised situation, but you know, which I think at times is good. It's good for players. It's good to put players under pressure.
And I guess part of the thriving aspect, Sean, as well, was that rivalry with Widnes. I mean, we spoke yesterday to Mark, and Mark was saying it. You kind of likened it to Liverpool and Manchester United in football. That was that serious rivalry between the two teams at the time.
It was worse than that.
Fortunately for us, we always seemed to get the big one, which was Wembley at the time. But I do remember clearly I think they won the championship regularly around in the late 80s, early 90s. I think they won one World Club championship. Was it
89?
Yeah, they did. We all went watching that, actually. All the old Wigan squad went to watch that. They played Canberra. And they had some excellent players. And as I said, Dougie always continued adding to the squad. Obviously, Martin Fayre was the standout. I mean, he's one of the best players I ever played with. Incredible try scorer. But they were big, they were physical. And, you know, particularly when you went to Knowsley Road, not Knowsley Road, to Norton Park, you knew he was in for a tough game. It was going to be a tough day at the office. And, as I said, you know, we both went at it toe-to-toe. But generally, we won the Challenge Cup, which was then deemed to be probably the biggest one.
Yeah. During your time at Wigan as well, Sean, we said at the start that you were always looking to learn and find that extra detail in the game. Was that something that you continued during your time at Wigan and then obviously led into your coaching role, because you were playing in such a good team, so it was quite easy to maybe learn the details from them?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I mean, I started writing notes on coaching when I was about 21. Obviously, at first, they were mainly rugby league, you know, coaching moves, different moves, tactics on the pitch, great quotes from great coaches, etc. But I always remember my mum, who's a very, very smart person, in 1995, when rugby union went professional, and she said to me that you ought to study rugby union now as well, because rugby union is going to be very big in the future. And she was right. And, you know, obviously I did study it. I wouldn't have as much knowledge as I've got now, obviously, back in when I first retired from rugby league. But I went to watch England train, and Clive Woodward was unbelievably helpful towards me. Ellery Hanley, my great friend and colleague, he was coaching he was a defence coach for the England Saxons at the time. And he invited me along to go and watch training, and I met Mr. Woodward, and he was absolutely fantastic with me. I can't tell you how good he was. And it really whetted my appetite to go back to rugby union, because number one, I wanted to be in London because I have a son in London and I wanted to be near him. And fortunately, I bumped into Nigel Melville. He was the boss of Wasps. He asked me what I was getting up to. I said, well, I want to become a coach. And he said, well, just come and give us a session, start the next season. And this was the last game of the season, and I did. And fortunately, he offered me a contract. So I was eternally grateful to Nigel Melville, because he was the one who took a chance on me, really, because I wasn't that qualified in rugby union, but I was qualified in the game of rugby, you know, handling skills, tackling skills, etc. So the detail came later of rugby union, but very, very thankful to Nigel Melville.
I bet. It seems you kind of started a bit of a trend with coaches coming over from rugby league, particularly sort of from a defensive perspective. Obviously, yourself at Wasps had Mike Ford, Mike Forshaw, Andy Farrell. What do you think the reason is that kind of rugby league coaches have been so successful coming over to Union?
I don't think it was me. I think it was Phil Larder, really, and a guy called Clive Griffiths. I think they were the two trailblazers who were involved in league, then came into Union. And Phil Larder is the only first defence coach in the Northern Hemisphere who's won the World Cup with England in 2003. Clive won the first Grand Slam for 20-odd years with Wales, and they're both great friends of mine and inspirations to me. So it wasn't really me, it was those people. They were the trailblazers, definitely, Phil Larder and Clive Griffiths. And I'm very, very thankful that they did that, because it obviously, within rugby league, there is, you know, obviously the teams in Yorkshire, the teams in Lancashire. But in rugby union, there's a lot more jobs. There's a lot more employment. Yeah. Reason being, every team has a forwards coach nowadays. Every team has an attack coach. Every team has a head coach, defence coach, and sometimes a kicking and aerial skills coach as well. So that's five different jobs. So
yeah.
And there's the Celtic League. There's the French League. There's the English League. You know, you can even go down to Down Under. I know a few guys have been in the Super Rugby. So it just opens up the whole world for a potential, you know, for even South Africa, a place like South Africa, you could go and coach down there. I know a few lads have been down there as well, as well as the Rugby League, which is the NRL, and obviously the Super League. So it opens up more avenues of coaching, because, you know, you obviously want to be in employment.
Yeah. And do you think there's a reason that these coaches coming over seem to have largely been so successful and so sought after?
Probably the fact that, obviously, those guys have been involved in a professional environment in the 80s and 90s. I'm not saying rugby union wasn't professional in the way they conducted themselves, but obviously, if you're playing for your livelihood, you're playing for... to feed your families, etc. The stakes just a little bit higher, you know. I'm not saying, obviously, amateur rugby players are incredibly professional in the past, and I notice a lot of the great team of the Welsh team in the 70s, a lot of them were PE teachers. Mm-hmm. So they were training all day. So they were really full-time professionals. I know Gareth Edwards... I was speaking to Lynn Davis, who was an incredible athlete, a long jumper. And he said that Gareth Edwards used to train with him all the time. And he said he was incredibly strong. You know, they'd be doing weights. This is back in the 60s, you know. So, you know, a lot about things about being naturally talented. I don't really go for that. There always has to be hard work behind it.
And Dave mentioned your time at Wasps there, Sean. And I guess that's when... you know, the partnership between you and Warren Gatland really began. And why do you think it worked so well? Was it the fact that you both had very similar ideas at that time at Wasps in terms of how the game should be played defensively?
Well, Warren was the one who brought in the rush defence. But when he said, I want to change the defensive system, we had a meeting actually, because things hadn't been going too well. I wasn't an instant success as a coach. It was well into the second year before we started having great results at Wasp. And I remember him saying, I wanted to do the like an umbrella style defence, a blitz defence, he called it. And I thought, well, that's what we used to do at Wigan. Because at Wigan, before 92, it was 5 yards. The rule was 5 yards. It's not always been 10 yards, rugby league. Everyone thinks it's always been 10 yards, but it's not. It was 5 yards. It was even less than that back in the 60s, but it was 5 yards. So we used to do the rush umbrella style defence at Wigan. When Mike Ford played, I would be on one side of the pitch, he'd be on the other. And our jobs under Graham Lowe was to rush up quickly and turn the opposition back inside. And I remember watching training at Wasp and thinking, you know, everybody was doing the up and out defence. And I remember thinking, watching it, and I was stood with the players and thinking, if I couldn't rush up quickly and cut that play off when I was a young lad in my 20s and early 30s, you know, if I couldn't stop that play because you're only like 1 yard back at the play of the ball, at the ruck, I'd throw my boots in the thing and never ever play again if I couldn't stop that, because it's not that hard to do. And I said this to Gats. I said, I've been thinking that for the last 4 months. Why don't we just rush up quickly? Well, that's what I want to do. I was like, yes, thank God, because I had no confidence in myself, believe it or not. I had no confidence in myself because things hadn't been going well at Wasp. You know, we're in the lower regions of the table, etc. And things hadn't been going well, so any ideas I had, I was a little bit. I was too scared to upset the apple cart, you know what I mean? Because things hadn't been going that well. Then Gats came along, and you know, we had the similar things of. I remember I said to him, Gats, I said, I don't understand why. Because back in them days, you could pass the ball back into the 22, then kick it out, if you remember. I said, well, they pass it back to 22, then they kick it out like 10 yards further from where they started. But some of these guys, I said, some of the best kickers I've ever seen in my whole life. They can kick the ball miles further than what rugby league players could do. Why don't they just kick it straight down pitch? Because I virtually guarantee the opposition will kick it out and we'll get line out there. He went, yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a great idea. I started having a bit of confidence in myself. Maybe I'm not as crap as I thought I was, you know, as a coach, like, you know. And that's when it all started, really.
Just on the Wasp stuff there and kicking as well, but Danny Cipriani's always spoken about you being a big character, a big influence in his development. Just how good is he and how did you get the best out of him?
I think Danny's probably better now than he was when I was coaching him, because he's had more experience, etc. Maybe not athletically as good, obviously in his 30s now, but definitely I've seen him play with Sale and Gloucester and everything, and you know, his organisational skills seem to be top draw to me. And if you have, for me, if you have such a strong character like that, like Danny, it's important to try to work with him, not against him. You know, ask his opinion. What sort of players do you think you're going to work on, a hit-back player? What sort of players do you want to go on the floor? So it's important to work with the coaches, particularly your pivot, your first receiver. You know, that's a position I played generally as a when I was playing for Wigan, etc. And I think it's good for the pivot to have some impact. It's a bit like a quarterback, isn't it, in American football. Similar thing, the quarterback has to have a little bit of input into what the offense is running, and I'm a big believer that in the fly half in rugby union, in the scrum half in rugby league, obviously. Them positions, you know, you need to chat with them and work with them, not against them.
And Danny obviously played his part as well, Sean, and sort of the success you guys had at Wasp and you were more than had at Wasp. I mean, what was that sort of like when you say there that you may have not had that confidence in yourself to begin with, then to have that chat with Warren, and then you see the development of the team over that period of time to then get the success that you did? It must have been very satisfying.
Yeah, Danny was a bit later than I think Warren signed Danny. It was about 16, 17, but when he got in the first team, Warren had gone back to New Zealand. But yeah, there's special times at Wasp because it was the best and the worst times for me, because I lost my brother in a car crash in 2003, and if I didn't have that job at Wasp, I don't know what would have happened to me, really. If anybody asks me advice when someone passes away who's very close to them or whatever, my only advice I can give is that to keep yourself busy. You know, keep yourself busy, keep yourself doing things, busy, 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 busy. Then you don't have time to mull and think about it too much. And as I said, that them Wasps lads really stuck by me. People like Lawrence and Alex King and just great lads, great, great lads. And there's still a real bond between us. Even, you know, what was it when we last won the last time we won a trophy at Wasps was 2008, so that's 12 years ago, which was the championship. And still a strong bond between us all.
Because I know at the time as well, Sean, that England was potentially on the table for yourself, but you talk about that strong bond for the Wasps lads. Was that another crucial thing for you during that time that you thought, no, do you know what? I've got Wasps to focus on. These guys are brilliant to work with. Let's just keep the mind busy and do what I do best at the moment.
Well, I got offered a position with England as a defence coach in 2006, I was very grateful for it from Mr. Robinson when he was in charge. And I spoke to my mum about it, and she just thought, it's too early for you after you brought this. Thing was at Wasps, I was head coach at the time. So Sunday we had a matches, Monday we had a second team game, Tuesday we all day training, Wednesday was day off, and I used to go down to East London and just tap around the boxing with my friends. Thursday we're back training, Friday, you know, every day something busy. Even in the off season, I'd go and do a coach in New Zealand or whatever. So I was just keeping myself busy all the time, so I didn't have time to lull and think about what had happened to my brother. And my mum said to me, because my mum said, I don't think you're ready yet. And I politely said, no. And as I said, I've only had three jobs in my life, really, as a coach. It was a Wasp, Wales, and now France. I've been in the game 20 years.
And I think we're perfectly on to sort of your time with Wales. Sean, obviously you relink with Warren Amin. Just tell us about that journey, because I know Rob will come in shortly on it, because he's, you know, an avid supporter of Wales over the years. But the rise of Wales since Warren took charge and you've been involved, Sean, has just been amazing to watch from the outside. So why do you think it has worked so well for Wales over the last decade or so?
Well, obviously, you know, we had the there has to be a player base of talent. I think we got the best out of them as much as we could. I think a lot of times Warren's the kind of guy who puts it on the line, and you know, we've got a lot of criticism about regularly losing to Australia. You know, but Australia at the time were one of the top three teams, so regularly we're playing against very, very good teams, and I think that was definitely one of the reasons that. You improve, and if you put yourself in an uncomfortable place, that's the sort of situations that makes you better, isn't it? Really, you either sink or swim, and you know, a lot of times, as I said, we had a lot of criticism over the years about not being able to beat Australia, but in the end, we ended up beating Australia three times on the bounce. In the end, we ended up beating South Africa five times on the bounce. Obviously, we lost the World Cup semi-final by the smallest margins, but. I think it, obviously playing that tough opposition all the time was definitely a help. It didn't feel like it at times because, you know, you're losing by one or two points again. It's Australia, which, you know, there's no doubt they were a bogey team to us. But you've got to remember as well, a lot of the times in the autumn internationals, you know, the Australians have come over. They've been together for 4 months. You know, with Wales, we've probably had about four training sessions. And it's no coincidence that we generally nearly always improved as the competitions went on. And by the, you know, the third and the fourth autumn international, we're usually, you know, up there competing very, very, very successfully.
And Six Nations success, Sean, is obviously a highlight for any coach and any player. But you talk about...
That's a competition I always thought you get judged on, you know. Autumn internationals, as I said, you don't have that much preparation, etc. But the Six Nations, to me, is the competition. We won it four times. We came second about three. So, them's the ones I think about more than anything. We could have won about six. That's what cheeses me off, to be honest.
That probably voids my next question, Sean, because I was going to say, you know, talk about those Southern Hemisphere teams. But did that drive you and Warren on to get better and get better, because you were getting those that close against your New Zealand, your South Africa, your Australians, and obviously it proved significant.
I think what happened is that a lot of the Southern Hemisphere teams used to come over, and if anybody beat them, it was quite a big story, you know. Mm. But what England had beaten Australia 6 times on the bounce now, you know. As I said, we had a good run against South Africa for a while. Ireland, I've had a great run. I've had a couple of good wins over New Zealand, and regularly beat South Africa and Australia. So it's not unusual for the Northern Hemisphere teams to win now. Mm. And I think that's one of the reasons that the British Lions have done so well over the last few years as well, is that the guys are just used to beating them now. Whereas before, I reckon 2008 when I first came in, it was quite unusual. It was a big story if Australia lost against, you know, on a tour, or, I mean, it'd always be a big story if the All Blacks lose, because they're the All Blacks, but, you know, South Africa, etc.
And just on working with Warren again, Sean, I mean, what is he like to work with? Because we, from my point of view, we see him in the media, he comes across so well, but what is he like to work with day in, day out on, when it comes to those big games?
He just keeps it simple, and his strength is that he doesn't get dragged up in the bullshit, mate. He doesn't get dragged up in the bullshit. By that, he tries to keep it simple, work on specific things. He lets his coaches coach as well. Sometimes he'll give a word of advice, but generally he doesn't get involved. But being a former hooker himself, that helps him, because he has an understanding of forwards play and backs play.
And Rob, just to bring you as the Wales fan, if you like it, you have seen the growth of Wales over the last decade or so. I mean, have you got some standout memories of the team over the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, as a Welsh supporter, you know, I go to Cardiff quite a bit. But the one game that sort of I vividly remember is when Wales beat Ireland, and I think it was the 2015 Six Nations, where Wales were camped on their own try line, you know, for what seemed like the whole of the second half. Wave after wave, Ireland would come, and you know, eventually, you know, you'd think that Ireland would find a way through, but Wales were so well drilled from Sean that day, and you know, that was the case for quite a lot of the games. You know, you'd think, how on earth have we stopped them scoring there? But you know, as a player, as a fullback, I wasn't too much of a fan of defending when I first started playing rugby. Like Sean said, rather attack than defend. But you know, I just wanted the ball in hand. But playing school in the Daily Mail Cup, probably the highest standard I played and will play. But you know, we had specific coaching drills on defensive organisation. It was guys, Brendan Thomas and Dave Baldwin would come in and drill us, you know. We'd work on just defensive organisation. But, you know, I learned to love defence. I saw it as my job to be the vocal guy at the back, sorting out the line of defence, making sure that there are no gaps. And there's no better feeling than being on your try line with your 14 mates and keeping the team out. There's no better feeling.
Brilliant, yeah. Good. I like that chat. Fantastic. You're almost like the goalkeeper. You're the guy in charge.
Yeah, the last line.
You know what I mean? And, I would always say to Lee Halfpenny, anything you want to cover, what do you want me to do? I need to hear your voice. And, you know, you got it bang on there, mate. You are the man in charge. And if your boys did well, you take credit for it.
You've coached so many great players in your time, Sean. I mean, is there anyone that stands out defensively for you in terms of the best player you've coached in that sort of area?
It's difficult to talk about that because like what a prop does to what a winger does, I'll tell you something, the hardest place to defend, or one of the hardest places, is wing.
Yeah.
Right? Everyone would think it's the easiest because you don't do so many tackles, etc. Wingers are all about attack. But if a winger makes a mistake in defence, it'll either turn into a line break or a try. And they could be on the wing not doing much for 15-20 minutes, and all of a sudden they have to make a big decision whether to step in or stay out. Get their alignment right, etc. It's a lot of pressure on wingers. When I'm coaching, I actually spend, I reckon, 35% of the time just coaching wingers.
Really?
Yeah. Fullbacks, similar. Fullbacks a little bit easier because there's not as many frontline decisions to make. But Yeah, the toughest, and nobody would ever guess it was the wingers. I spent more time with the wingers because, as I said, I'm the best defensive winger I ever coached, and I coached some great defensive wingers. Josh Lucy was very good. It was Paul Sackey. Remember Paul Sackey used to play for England? Yeah, yeah. He was a very, very good defensive player, and probably the best defensive player winger in his position. Very intelligent guy, who knows when to step in, when to stay out, etc. Josh Adams is very good as well, very, very good. George North improved a lot because he was very raw at start, and so was Shane Williams. Had to work very hard with Shane Williams, but they all had great attitudes and they all wanted to get better. And I'd like to think we had a positive effect on the defence.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that show, Sean, because of the success that you guys have had at Wales, and obviously the World Cup was something last year that a lot of people were talking about. I mean, how do you look back on the 2019 World Cup? Because, you know, Wales were so strong in that tournament, but the semi-final was just unfortunately the final hurdle.
Yeah, well, we had some luck along the way. I mean, obviously France having the player sent off was a big turning point. You know, getting interceptions, etc., helped us against France. You know, against Australia, we had a lot of tough games. And if you look at the schedule that we had compared to some of the other teams, we were pretty beaten up by the end of it. By the semi-final, I think some of the guys were playing in with quite serious injuries, really. But that's what you've got to do to win a World Cup. It's not going to be all smooth. It's not going to be all nice and cosy. And unfortunately, you know, we failed by 3 points against South Africa once again, who've been a bit of a nemesis for us at the World Cup 2015. Scored the last few minutes to beat us. 2019, you know, obviously they had a goal kicker who couldn't hit a barn door in the previous quarter final, and then he kicked every single thing. He's a brilliant player, so fair play to him. And I always knew when everyone seemed to think that it was going to be a walking day for England in the final, and I just couldn't see that, because South African forwards are so big, they're so physical. The defence was very different to what the All Black style of defence was, so I knew it was going to be a very close game, at least for England. Oh, my daughter's here. She wants to talk.
Come on, get her on. Hello.
The sandals. That's Kitty, my daughter.
Hi, Kitty.
Hi.
Okay. See you in a bit. Yeah, she's been shopping apparently. Yeah, so I knew South Africa. I didn't, you know. Everyone just seemed to think because they beat the All Blacks England, but styles make fights and styles make games of rugby as well. So I always knew it was going to be difficult there for England.
You said South Africa was a nemesis as well, Sean, and you also went on obviously
the World Cup. In the World Cups. I mean, we're beating five on the bounce in between, but nearly all of them games were by one score. Mm. So it just shows that, you know, it's good competition, isn't it? That's what sport's about.
Because I was going to touch on a negative point with South Africa again, was obviously with the Lions in 2009. But that was, again, another probably string to your bow to your coaches as well, to go on a tour to South Africa.
That's the worst loss of my career, really. Second test, you know, in Pretoria, that second game. You know, for that guy just only get 10 minutes for gouging someone.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely incredulous. I did. I mean, I'm a big fan of Schultzberger. He seems a great guy, but he goes someday, you know. And a couple of tries were let in. You know, one of our guys was unconscious and should have been brought off. Unfortunately, we got all the alignment all wrong, and we had no tail gunner on one of the tries. So yeah, it's probably the worst loss of my career is that, and the one it still bugs me to this day. I had a chance to go and beat them if possible, but I'm in France now, so can't qualify for British Lions.
Well, could you not mention the France going to on tour to South Africa? Can you get that one initiated?
Yeah, it's a good idea.
It's a good idea.
Australia, same time, I'm not sure. Are we going anywhere at the moment? Because obviously what's going on at the moment is we don't know when we're going to be able to start playing again. Let's hope it's soon.
Because I was going to say, it wasn't, you know, the final swan song that you all were and probably would have been hoping for at the World Cup in 2019, Sean. But France comes around for you. And why was France so appealing to you for you at the time? Is it because you'd sort of plied your trade and done so well in the home nations, if you like?
Well, they're the team who came with the more serious offer. You know, most of the offers were around about the same. But they're a guaranteed 4.5-year deal, and I've got three little girls here who need their daddy working. And they like having the toys, don't you, Ida? This is my other daughter.
Daddy, what? Look at my new shoes.
Wow. Show the guys your new shoes.
Wow. Oh, look at that.
Somebody's got to pay for them, and that's me. Yeah, so it's a guaranteed 4.5-year deal, and hopefully we've got a little bit of potential over there. I mean, I don't think we're there yet. I think we've got a bit way to go, it's been positive. And the guys who I work with are great guys as well. People like William Servat, fantastic people.
And how's that move been for you and the family, Sean? Have you adapted well to life in France? How's the language going?
Yeah, language is, I worked pretty hard, to be honest. Even when I was in the World Cup, in the days off, I'd be trying to, you know, do an hour of French on my own in my room, whatever, you know, obviously on the days off. Because I didn't want to go there and not be able to speak any French. I left school when I was 15 to be a professional rugby player. And it wasn't easy for me. So I've got to a stage now where I do all my coaching in French. I do my presentations in French. I've got to say, I do cheat a little bit. I've got a little bit, it's written down there. I just have a little glint in the loop when the boys are not looking at me. But yeah, it is difficult. There's no doubt about it. It is difficult to speak another language, particularly, you know, remember, I'm not 22. I'm not 16 anymore. And I think as your brain gets older, it's a little bit harder to learn. But I'm having a crack. I'm having a go. Yeah. And a couple of lads came up to me during the competition and they said, "Geez, I didn't realise you're all right at French, aren't you?" And I was like, "Do you really think so?" I thought I was terrible. So yeah. So that's where I'm at the moment.
And it seems that you managed to get your message across quite clearly, Sean, in that first sort of Six Nations game. And I saw a piece on the BBC you did beforehand with Dave Woods talking about sort of your move over, and there was a lot of talk about you in that game, and everyone came away from it saying Sean Edwards has made an instant impact. What did you think after that game when everyone was talking like that?
What helped me a lot when I went over to France was the fact that Fabien Galthié was the defence coach for France in the World Cup. And he incorporated a similar style of defence to what we were doing with Wales. So a lot of things the boys were it wasn't new to them, you know, to rush up quickly, etc. There's obviously some details were a little bit different. But they were already very, very well coached by Fabien, who's an excellent coach in attack and defence.
Yeah, absolutely, Sean. And in terms of the here and now, you mentioned there the situation we're in at the moment due to the coronavirus and the lockdown, and the bigger picture is far more important than rugby. But for you, you know, just getting your teeth into a new job with France, so it must be quite a strange time for you that, you know, three or four games into your Six Nations campaign and it's sort of come to a halt.
Yes, It was disappointing the last game. You know, we were hoping to go, you know, we got the whole of France behind us, really. And, you know, the away support at Scotland was absolutely incredible. How many French people was there? Unfortunately, we have to learn as a group. Rugby's a lot easier with 15 players on the pitch as opposed to 14. You know, we had a number of players, Simbind as well, in the competition. And if you look at it, you know, we've actually played, out of the four games, we played a full game with no players, with 14 players, with two sin bins, another sin bin in another match. So it's over one game, you know. For me, we've had to defend with 14 players. So it's something we need to sort out. We need to eradicate, because you can undo all the planning in the world, you know, and it must be heartbreaking for the lads, for the lads, French lads who went to the World Cup, you know, to for that guy to do that bit of indiscipline was disappointing for them. And it's very, very difficult to defend at the moment. There's never been as many points scored in rugby union as there is at the moment. Never, ever in history. And it does surprise me sometimes when they talk about we need some more points and there's more tries. And well, there's never been as many tries scored as there is in rugby union at the moment. Never, ever. And it's difficult to defend at the moment. And if you're defending with 15, it's difficult. If you're defending with 14, obviously, it's even more difficult. And we need to learn that.
Because what Rob mentioned yesterday, Sean, when we were talking, that it must be difficult as a defence coach because the rugby's changing and the laws are changing all the time. So every day is sort of a new challenge for you, I suppose, in rugby union at the moment.
As I said, you know, if you look at the scores 10 years ago, there wouldn't be nowhere near as many as there are now. You know, that's why I said when Wales conceded two tries in 2008, that record will last for, I think it'll last for a long time. Even though Scotland was the best defence this year so far, and they defended very, very well. And the record Wales set in 2013 to go, was it 4.5 games that conceded a try, that'll never be beaten the way the rules are at the moment, because it's, you know, obviously, and I think most people come to see tries. But I just hope we don't get to a situation where a try is actually devalued a little bit. There is other sports where, you know, scoring every minute or so is an acceptable thing. Personally, I don't think it would be good for rugby. I think tries have to be earned. I like watching a tough tactical game, me as well, you know, a little bit of kicking and, you know, good competition at the breakdown, competition in the lineouts, competition in the scrums. I think that's important to have that as well as a good attacking play.
Absolutely, Sean. And just finally from me, in terms of France going forward, obviously the World Cup is going to be held there in 3 years' time now. How much is the country looking forward to that? And how much are you looking forward to being part of that process, hopefully? Because it seems that your work during the Six Nations is right, that's the start point, and the end point is hopefully the World Cup final in 2023.
Yeah, I would hate if it to become a chore on a weight on your shoulders, the weight of expectation. I think it's important that, you know, you remember it. It's just a game of rugby in the end, and the guys are not stupid. They know that all the people in France are. Wherever you're playing, that they all want you to win. In the end, you've got to think about, I've got to make my first tackle. I've got to clean my first ruck. I've got to catch the ball. Because that's what wins you the games in the end, isn't it?
So that was our special Looseheads podcast in association. We're talking rugby union with Sean Edwards. Unbelievably privileged to hear his stories and honoured to speak to him this afternoon. And I think, guys, you know, you just... all of us were so inspired and gripped by what you were saying, weren't we?
Yeah, I think with Sean, he's the WYSIWYG, isn't he? What you see is what you get. If I take one thing from Sean Edwards, it's if I could adopt the Sean Edwards attitude in life, I think life gets eminently easier to live. It's a privilege to speak to him.
And also, Mark, on that, it's obviously, you said it in the podcast, but a privilege to have him as patron of Looseheads.
Oh, unbelievably. Yeah. We won't go far wrong with a guy like him endorsing what we do.
Absolutely, absolutely. Very well put, Mark. And it's been another brilliant special Looseheads podcast. But I know we've got a bit of admin to finish. So, Dave, over to you in terms of the website and the relaunch of the merchandise, if that's right.
Yep. So we're kind of back up and running to some sense of normality. So head over to looseheads.co.uk. That's spelt with a Z because we're cool like that. And as a special thank you for sticking with us through our latest podcasts, enter code POD for 10% off at checkout.
Brilliant, brilliant, Dave. So that's been another Loose Heads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union. Keep in touch with the guys over this week, with it being Mental Health Awareness Week. So they're doing great work, so keep across all Loose Heads social media channels. But thanks very much for listening to this special podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it.